Well, good evening. Good to see everybody tonight. We appreciate so much you being here on this Wednesday evening, braving the inclement weather tonight to be with us. We hope you've had a good day and glad we can stay together for just a few minutes tonight. I want to tell you at the very beginning tonight how much I have enjoyed being with you for these past 4 days. It's been an interesting 4 days. I've been in Tingsboro for 4 days and experienced all four seasons of the year. Just not everywhere you can do that. But I have enjoyed being with you immensely once again. It'd be hard to express how much I have. I appreciate this church very, very much. The reputation of this church and what you have done in this area over the past many decades now is known far and wide. And I appreciate you so very much, and I appreciate the opportunity to have been with you this week. I'm grateful for the invitation of your shepherds and for the opportunity to talk about this week the things that have to do with our family life, our home life, with our children, with our marriages, as we think about being good stewards of what we have, and tonight as we think for a few moments about remembering and honoring our vows. I'm very happy that Mike and Monica are with you. It seems to me that that's kind of a good hand-in-glove fit, and I'm very happy that they are here, and I know you are as well from things that you have said to me this week, and I pray that that will be just the relationship that you and that they want that to be. And I have certainly enjoyed this week being in the home of Mo and Janet once again. They, they have the perfect balance in keeping somebody in their home. They tend to you and they make you feel very, very welcome, but by the same token, they kind of let you have the space to do what you need to do. They just have that perfect balance down. And that's come through experience and through opening their home to countless people I know. And I have enjoyed that very, very much. And thanks to all of you who've been so encouraging this week. You've had so many encouraging and uplifting things to say, and I just cannot tell you how much that has meant to me and how much you have helped me this week by the good way you've listened, by the kind things that you have had to say, and by the time that we have visited together. That has meant a lot to me, and I thank you for that. I go home tomorrow. I leave you to your northeast winter, and I will go home to 80 degrees. I used to live in the north and remember what winter was like. There are some things about the north that I miss. I miss this time of year very, very much. But I have enjoyed being with you this week. On Sunday morning, one of the things that we said by way of beginning was that approximately 4 million people will marry in America this year. They will stand before family and friends and God, and they will promise, they will vow, they will pledge to each other that they will live with each other, with their mates, until by death they part. And I will tell you that I believe with all of my heart, that most everybody who makes those vows intends to keep that commitment. But you know and I know that before 15 years pass, almost one half of them will not. And we also know that that is not merely an academic issue. The fact of the matter is that you would be hard-pressed to find a single family, even among the Lord's people, who has not been touched in some way, somehow, in their family by a broken marriage. And I think all of that emphasizes the fact that we need to think very seriously about what it means when we make those vows and when we exchange those commitments as Christians. Because for the Christian, this is an important issue. We are men and women who claim to honor the sovereignty of God. We are men and women who believe that the authority of God's Word is binding upon us, and so we believe that we must be distinctively faithful to our promises. Because we are men and women who have read God say things like this: when you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it. He has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin. Do not say before the messenger of God that this was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? You know, we've heard that verse many, many times, but I want to emphasize tonight that the point that is made in that is that when we make a vow, a pledge, a promise before God, this business of the messenger of God coming to you is God coming to you and saying, did you not make this promise to me? And if you made this promise, I am expecting you to keep the vow that you have made. That's very important. In the 15th Psalm, the psalmist asks, Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle and who may dwell in your holy hill? And the essence of that is, Lord, with whom will you have fellowship? And the answer, there are a multiplicity of answers that are given, about seven as I recall, but one of them is the one who swears to his own hurt and does not change. God takes that seriously because he has been a witness between you and the wife or the husband of your youth. In other words, God takes our vows very, very seriously, and he expects that we will do that as well. I think what all of us want are to do that very thing. I think what we want are marathon marriages. Marriages that begin well and they end well, and they not only survive those middle years, but they thrive in those middle years as well. I don't think anybody who ever gets married really wants to end up like the old couple. They were both 90 years old, the man and his wife, and they went to an attorney and they said, you know, we want a divorce. And the attorney looked at him and he said, how old are you two? And they said, well, we're 90 years old. He said, how long have you been married? They said, we've been married 70 years. He said, why on earth would you want to get a divorce now? And one of them said to him, well, we were just waiting for the children to die. Well, I don't think any of us want to be in that circumstance. We want marathon marriages. We want to get marriages that begin well and they end well, but those middle years that often bring difficulty and challenges, that we navigate through them well, we survive and we thrive. Now, you and I both know that that doesn't just happen. That requires a tremendous amount of commitment to continually doing a bit of remodeling to our marriage. We have to keep working on the communication and keep working on to keep romance alive and on the financial issues as we spoke last night and on the intimate relationship as we spoke Sunday morning in the Bible class. Generally, we must continue to constantly work on that marriage. Now, we need to debunk a myth right here, and that is, and somehow, marathon marriages that last, that span the decades, that really they don't have any major problems. Well, that's really not true, is it? It's not true at all. We have said in this series that there is no such thing as this one perfect person finding this other perfect person, and together they come and they form a perfect union. Real life isn't that way. We said on Sunday morning that every marriage involves two imperfect people living in an imperfect world. And so when the difficulties develop, as we said Sunday, it's easy to buy that grass is greener on the other side of the fence mentality. But let me say this again. The grass is greener on the side of the marital fence where it is watered, where it is taken care of, where both individuals in the marriage are doing and giving their very best. The key to that, I think, is something that Jesus said in Matthew 7. You have a Bible tonight? Let's go to the mountain message and read just a little bit together. Matthew 7, and we're going to the end of Matthew 7. By the time you get to the end of Matthew 7, you're at the end of the Sermon on the Mount. And Jesus, for all intents and purposes, we would say, is about to extend his invitation. Now, I don't think that he said, let's all stand and sing. But he did come to the end of that sermon and say, there are choices that you must make. And he sets out before them two ways that they can go, two choices that they can make. And let's read what he said beginning in verse 24. He says, therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on a rock. And rain descended, and floods came, and the wind blew and beat on that house. But it did not fall because it was founded upon rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who's built his house on sand. And rain descended, floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell. And great was its fall. Now, what I want you to see in that tonight is that whether they were wise or foolish, in both of those instances, rains came, and wind blew, and floods rose. And I would tell you tonight that in every marriage that is going to happen, that in every marriage, there are going to be some rains of culture that are going to challenge us. And there are going to be winds of change that will challenge us. And there will be flood of adversity that will challenge us. And every marathon marriage must find a way to survive those three things. Let's talk about those for just a second before we really get where we're going tonight. The fact of the matter is that every marriage in 2011 is going to have to survive the rain of culture. rain that we're experiencing today soaks everything, and so culture permeates our lives. And just like rain can erode a foundation, culture can erode a marriage if we are not careful. Building a marathon marriage has never been an easy thing to do. But has there ever been a culture that makes it any more difficult than ours does today? George Gallup of the Gallup Polling Institute said that there are four factors that are mitigating against long-term marriages in the 21st century. He said those four things are these. Number one, alternative lifestyles. That is, never before have we been inundated with such propaganda and pressure to accept all kinds of alternative lifestyles as though they are normal. The idea of one man and one woman for life is almost unheard of in common American thought. And secondly, he said, sexual immorality. That is, that so often now individuals enter a marriage relationship and it is almost a foregone conclusion that surely one, if not both of them, are going to be unfaithful to their mate. There's almost an expectation that immorality now is going to become a part at some point of the marriage relationship. And thirdly, he talked about material greed. That is, an addiction to materialism destroys marriages. We talked about that last night. And sometimes we say that we are doing that for our family, we want to give them better things, but in reality, oftentimes what a family needs is a mom and dad who are devoting their time to mom and dad and to those children. And fourthly, Gallup talked about radical feminism. And he didn't mean by that equal pay for equal work or anything like that. He was talking about the fact that in America in the 21st century, the common perception is that a woman's worth and value is diminished somehow if she finds fulfillment in her home and in her children. And the point that's being made is a very simple one. That these reins of culture, if we are not careful, ladies and gentlemen, can permeate and erode the foundations of marriage, and they are a challenge. They're a challenge to everyone as we try to live in this world. Well, what do we do about that? Well, I'll tell you what we do. We live the principle of Exodus 23 and verse 2, where Moses said, "You shall not follow a multitude to do evil." That is, you don't allow the world to do the thinking for you. And secondly, we need to talk just a moment about the winds of change. Because the fact of the matter is that change, the winds of change, blow into every single marriage. Things that are alive change. Everything changes in a marriage. When you marry, over the course of time, naturally, things are going to change, and we have to deal with that. For example, we're going to change physically, and there is no denying that. As we age, we change a little bit. I read a story, Reader's Digest had a story a while back, about a lady who walked in the den of her house, and her husband was spread out on the couch, and he was taking a nap. And she looked at him, and she went over and sat down by his side on the edge of the couch, and he woke up, and she reached down, and she took his glasses off of him. And she said, "You know, honey, without your glasses, you are still a very handsome man." And he looked at her and he said, "You know, without my glasses, you are still a very beautiful woman." Well, he probably shouldn't have said that. But the fact of the matter is, we change a little bit physically. It is inevitable as time goes on. And we change financially. Now, most of us, when we married, we were rather poor. And then we had children, and we entered absolute poverty. And then we tried to send them to college, and we knew what destitution was. Well, we changed a little bit. No, really, most of us, as we said last night, most of us have torn down barns and built bigger. We've increased a little bit. But as we also talked last night, there are ups and downs that come with that. And certainly that's been the case over the past 3 years in America. We change intellectually. Hopefully, we change for the better. Hopefully, we continue to grow. And that leads us, as we change spiritually, to being growing closer to the Lord, and in that, growing closer to each other. But the fact of the matter is, we will change in all of those ways. The issue is not whether or not those changes are going to come into our life. It is whether or not we are going to see them as things that are beneficial and that we use to make us better and not bitter. And then finally, the flood of adversity. Because floods of adversity, again, inevitably are going to flow into every marriage. Now, some of those things we bring on by ourselves, sometimes by our poor choices, or maybe by our
bad behavior. Some of those things we have very little control over. And so you lose a job after 20 years of faithful and loyal service, or you have the rebellion of a child that you have tried to rear in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, or you have a doctor's report that says terminal, or you develop an addiction that dogs your every step, or the death of a loved one, or again a financial setback of some kind. All kinds of adversity comes into life, sometimes again brought on by our own bad behavior or decision, sometimes through no fault of our own. The issue is, what do we do with that adversity? I mean, you may be in this building tonight. You'd be somewhere trying to navigate the floodwater of adversity in your life. What you need to know about that is that God knows about that and God cares about that. In fact, God said through Isaiah, when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they will not overflow you. And when you walk through the fire, you will not burn, nor shall the flames scorch you. I am the Lord your God. I am the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. And I will tell you that we need to be careful here, as with a lot of prophecy, that we do not read into it more than God intended. I want you to notice two things about this passage that sometimes we don't particularly care for. The first is the path. Did you notice that? He said you may well have to go through the waters, and you may have to go through the river and through the fire. We would rather God not make us do that. But the fact of the matter is that there are circumstances that arise in life that we have to try as best we can to navigate wisely through. And that's exactly what God says. And the second thing often we don't like in this passage is the pace. Not just the path, but the pace. And that is when you walk. And sometimes that's what you have to do. We would rather that say when you fly, when you zip through, when you soar over that. But that's not the way that is. Most adversity that comes into our life, if we're going to get through it on the other side and have learned something from it so that we're better on the other side of the equation, then we're going to have to go through it. And we have to walk through that. Walking means to proceed one step at a time. And so one step at a time, we've got to navigate our way through that adversity. And so, the rain of culture, the winds of change, and the flood of adversity, those are going to come into every marriage. Now, the question, ladies and gentlemen, is how do we navigate that successfully? And what I want to say to you tonight is that we do that by remembering and honoring our vows. And I want to talk about that for just a moment tonight, if I may. I want us to talk for just a moment about the vows we make when we marry. You know, I think probably for most of us, after our wedding ceremony, we've never given much thought to what we promised on that day. But I want to tell you, we made a promise to our mate before God and others. And I tell you, our mate probably hasn't forgotten that. And I'll guarantee you that God has not forgotten about that. And so we would do well to think about that a little bit, I believe. When I do a marriage ceremony, unless the bride and groom tell me that they want to write their own vows, then I typically use the old traditional marriage vows. And it's not because they're in the Bible or because they are what God commands us to use. But I use those because they are biblically based in many ways. And secondly, so that when this couple goes to a wedding for the rest of their life, they're probably going to hear something very similar to what they promised to each other. And they'll be reminded of that. And so I want us to think a little bit about what we vowed. Well, I vowed and I said, I, Don Truex, take you, Vicky King. When you're filling in your sheet, don't write my name there. Write your name and your mate's name. But I said, I, Don Truex, take you, Vicky King. And I will tell you, ladies and gentlemen, for all the things that we promise in our marriage ceremonies, that may well be the most difficult thing that we ever keep as a vow. Because when we say that, we are saying, look, I am taking you as you are. I am believing that you have been honest and open with me about who you really are, and who you really are is presented to me in this, as we have dated and been engaged. I am taking you. I understand that marriage is not a vehicle for me to try to reform you into someone that I want you to be. I saw this cartoon a while back that I liked. Two ladies are having coffee, and one says to the other, "We can't afford to remodel the house right now, so I'm planning to redo Bob instead." Well, I've often thought about that. I wonder how Bob felt about that. Probably wasn't very happy about that. No, when we say, "I take you," then I am acknowledging that there are going to be a great many positives in you that will bless my life, maybe some negatives that may bother me, but because we love each other, we will do our best to eliminate those negatives and accentuate those things that will bring each other great happiness. Secondly, to be my lawfully wedded wife, or to be my lawfully wedded husband. There are two things that we have promised in that. The first is that we are acknowledging that we are promising that there's going to be a weaving process that will take place here. That from this day forward, I am going to weave my life together with yours. That it's not going to simply be about me anymore. It's not just my money, it is our money. It's not my time, it is our time. I am accountable to you. I'm accountable to you for where I go and what I do. And it's our future together. I realize that every couple needs some space. Everybody does that. But we are saying in this, look, we are going to weave our life together in the way that a husband and wife should. And second thing that we promise in that is that we will do that lawfully. Let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen, for Christians, that does not have reference to the fact that there are going to be some papers filed in the courthouse so that this union is acknowledged by the state of Massachusetts. That's not what that is talking about. Not for Christians anyway. We are saying, I am going to live with you. I'm promising God and you that I will live with you the way that God says a husband will live with his wife and a wife with her husband. We're going to live our marriage according to the laws of God Almighty. We promise in that. We say to our mate, I am promising you that I will live with you according to the God-ordained standard for a mate. We're saying in that that God's law applies to me. I understand. I'm promising you that I know God's law applies to me. I read a story about Muhammad Ali when he was heavyweight champion of the world. He was flying somewhere, and the flight attendant came down the aisle, and she looked and she said, "Mr. Ali, you must buckle your seatbelt." And Muhammad Ali looked at her and he said, "Little lady, let me tell you something. Superman don't need no seatbelt." And she looked at him and said, "Mr. Ali, Superman don't need an airplane. Buckle up." And the point of that was that the law applied to him, just like it did to everyone else. And so when we marry and we say, I take you to be my lawfully wedded mate, I am promising my mate that I will weave my life together with them according to the law of God, to have and to hold the only claim in the marriage vows at a personal right. We talk Sunday morning in the Bible class period that when we marry, our body belongs to our mate. We talked about the fact Sunday morning that we vow to our mate in that, to have and to hold, we vow sexual fidelity. It would be absolutely impossible, ladies and gentlemen, to calculate the damage that has been done through infidelity in marriage. And yet amazingly, hardly a week goes by that we don't hear, that we don't know of somebody whose marriage has been just decimated because of infidelity on the part of one. We need to remember that when we marry, from that point on, we have no right to ever be making advances to the person of the opposite sex, nor to be receptive to the advances of anybody of the opposite sex other than our mate. And this is from this day forward. From now on. From this day forward, our relationship is different. Different than when we dated. Different than when we were engaged. From now on, it's different. I've done marriage ceremonies a couple of times and had the bride and groom come to the back after they walk to the back and the wedding party goes out and I finally dismiss all the audience. I've gone to the back and I've had a bride and groom on occasion say, "Are you sure we're married?" I say, "Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I think you're married. You're married." And that's always been an amazing question to me. I mean, here we are. They have planned for this day. They have spent the bride's father's life savings on this day. And they can't figure out they're really married. Yes, you are married. From this day forward, it's different. I always tell young men who are about to become married, from this day forward, and I always say to young men about to be married, you need to remember this day forward, every time it rolls around every year, that it may be well with you and your life may be long on this earth. Because that's an important day. We're acknowledging that our life is going to be different from this day forward, for better or for worse. And that's important to understand. Because what we are acknowledging in that is that our marriage, like every marriage, will have some for worse times. Times when we don't feel romantic and we may pick at each other. A time when there are financial difficulties and we may blame the other person. Our attitude at that point is going to make or break the relationship. There are always going to be better times in a marriage and worse times in a marriage. And we need to be careful that we are not a party to making times difficult with our mate. I was in a meeting somewhere, I can't remember where this was now. I was in a meeting somewhere and I'd gone into a card shop and I was looking for a card to send back to my wife, Vicki. And so I'm looking at cards and I find a card that on the front says, "I love you more today than yesterday." Well, that's nice sentiment, isn't it? And I knew that what was going to be on the inside was the second line of the lyric of the song that says, "But not as much as tomorrow." So I thought, well, that would be a nice card to send. So I picked it up, and on the front, "I love you more today than yesterday." But when I opened it on the inside, it said, "Because yesterday, you really got on my nerves." Well, I didn't buy that card. I mean, 35 years of marriage have taught me something, you know. But the fact is, there are days like that. There are days like that in every marriage. But we promise for better or for worse, and for richer or for poorer. And there are two sides of that equation. Financial problems put a stress on a marriage. There is no doubt about that. It is one of the three great breakers of marriages. But financial prosperity for some can be a problem equally daunting. We have all seen couples that did well during the early days of marriage, a struggle, but then promotions came and things came and pressures came and sometimes flirtations came and sometimes idle time and moves and sometimes all of that combines to tax the endurance of the relationship. And we need to vow that whichever side of that equation we may find ourselves on, for richer or for poorer, that it will not alter the devotion that we give to our mate in sickness and in health. And both sides of that equation will come certainly as well. In health, it's pretty easy. The sickness time is a little more challenging. You ever notice, ladies and gentlemen, on television and in the movies that very rarely is anybody ever sick in a marriage? Very rarely ever see somebody, a mate in a marriage that has the flu, or you have a mate that is debilitated by some terrible disease or incident in their life. But in real life, of course, if you live long enough, chances are pretty good that one mate will have to take care of the other. I read a while back about a couple who had been married for 56 years. 56 years. In the last 3 years of their marriage, the wife had suffered terribly with Alzheimer's. And finally, she had to have nursing home care. And she was so debilitated that she couldn't even feed herself. And her husband went every day, three times a day, and fed his wife for three meals. And the nursing staff, as they saw that and as they talked to him every day, they told him repeatedly, they said, "Look, you don't have to do this. We will take good care of your wife. We will feed her. You do not have to do this." And he said, "Thank you." He said, "But I made a promise when we got married, in sickness and in health."
Now, your mate may not suffer from some debilitating disease such as that, but you can mark it down, ladies and gentlemen. As we live and as we age, it is inevitable that there will be difficulties that will come into our life. And to love and honor and cherish. And I want to say just a word about that, if I may, because that's an important thing that we vow. To love and to honor and to cherish. It is an acknowledgement that there are other kinds of love and tenderness and affection in a marriage beyond the sexual. And if I may say to the men in this audience in particular, your wife needs love and tenderness beyond simply the sexual affection. And if the only time that you are tender and kind to your wife, if the only time that you truly listen to her, if the only time that you're patient with her is when you have a sexual agenda in mind, she will feel, and rightfully so, she will feel used. You vowed and promised better than that. You promised to love and honor and cherish her. It's easy to forget that sometimes. Several years ago, probably close to 18 years ago now, I was with a congregation in a gospel meeting, and there was a young family that invited me home on Sunday night with them. And they were a young, beautiful young family. The husband and wife looked like Ken and Barbie dolls. And they had two children. They had a boy and a girl, and they had a dog. They were the quintessential American family. And we're sitting in the kitchen, and this young bride, she's scurrying around and trying to get us something to eat put together. And this young man, this young husband and dad, he's talking to me, and he is catering to me, and he's trying to anticipate anything that I might want, and he is being so kind to me and deferential to me in every way, and he is talking so nicely and kindly to me. But he talked to his wife as though she were no better than that dog. And I remember thinking to myself, son, you have no idea what you are doing. The kind of wound you are causing and the hurt that you are doing to your bride. I've been back to that congregation probably 4 to 5 other times since then. The last time I was with them, those two children now are grown. They're in college. And when I was with them 2 years ago in a gospel meeting, they're still married to each other. But they are two individuals simply living under the same roof. The body language between them says that there is a coldness and an antagonism that is almost palpable. And you could see that coming all those years ago. Because this young man didn't understand that he promised to love and to honor and to cherish. And then finally, we promise that this will be the way we will live until by death we part. You know, it's said that when Cortez landed in the New World that he burned his ships behind him as a message to his men. We're staying here. There's no going back. And in essence, that's what we do when we marry. We say, I'm staying. As we saw the other night, the only exception to that is when Jesus said that one may put away an adulterous man, infidelity. It is the thing that in the book of Malachi, God said, you know what, when a maid is sexually unfaithful to their husband or to their wife, to whom they have made these vows and pledges and promises, the language that God used in the book of Malachi was that you have done violence to that wife. You have done treachery to that wife. Because you took a relationship where you promised trust and commitment and security, and you delivered disloyalty and betrayal. You took those vows and you did not keep them. And God expects better of us, ladies and gentlemen. The most essential ingredient, I think, to a happy and successful marriage is to make that commitment. For two individuals who stand before God and man and before each other, they make that commitment with the resolve that they will keep it. I want to read you something tonight as we close. I very rarely ever read to an audience. Audiences don't like to be read to, and I know that. But I'm going to ask you to indulge me for just a second. I want to read you something. This comes from Dr. James Dobson, that I would imagine many of you have read after in some way or another. And it's from his book, Straight Talk. And it's a little snippet. When Dr. Dobson's parents had died, and he was going through their effects, he found a letter that his father had written to his mother in the days just before they were married. And he included it in his book. And I'd like to read to you what Dr. Dobson's father said to his mother just before they were married. Would you listen carefully, and then we'll be finished tonight. He said to his bride, prospective bride, "I want you to understand and to be fully aware of my feelings toward the marriage covenant which we are about to enter. I have been taught at my mother's knee and in harmony with the Word of God that the marriage vows are inviolable, and that by entering into them, I am bonding myself to you absolutely and for life. The idea of estrangement from you, for any reason at all, although God will allow one, that is infidelity, will never at any time be allowed to enter my thinking. I am not naive in this. On the contrary, I am fully aware of the possibility, as unlikely as it now appears, that unforeseen circumstances could result in difficulty. I am resolved for my part to accept that as a consequence of the commitment I make to you. I have loved you dearly as a sweetheart, and I will continue to love you as my wife. But over and above that, I love you with a Christian love that demands that I will never act toward you in a way that would jeopardize our prospects of entering heaven together, which is the supreme objective of both of our lives. And I pray that God Himself will make our love perfect and eternal." Well, that marriage lasted because these were two individuals who took those vows seriously. I would say to you, if you're in this audience tonight and you are not married, that you listen to something that Mr. Dobson said carefully. The prospects of entering heaven together. And I would say that for all that we've said this week to husbands and wives, that if you are here and you are not married, and that will be in your future, that you make certain that you marry someone who is going to help you go to heaven. And I pray that God Himself will make our love perfect and eternal. Thank you for listening so well tonight. Would you open your songbooks, please, to the number that was announced a moment ago? We'll sing that song in just a second as a hymn of invitation. Remembering and honoring our vows. You know, I read a book several years ago entitled Baptism, the Believer's Marriage Ceremony. And it just talked about the fact that when we are baptized, we make promises and vows to God that we're going to be faithful to Him from this day forward. And that this relationship that we're entering, we intend to be faithful until the day we die. Maybe you're here tonight and you know it. You're at a point in your journey of faith. You know you need to be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins. Or maybe you haven't been faithful. You know you need to come home to Him. And there would be a better night than tonight. And so if there's a response to God that you need to make in a public way and we can help you, please let us. Let's stand and let's sing.